All right. Good morning. How are we doing? We are awake. It is 9 a.m. on a Saturday morning, and that means that you are committed if you are here. Thank you so much for being here. If you are in the breakout that you want to be in, this breakout is called What Your Teen Wishes They Could Tell You. So if you're wanting to be in a different one, now is your chance to escape and get to a different breakout. But this is what we're going to be talking about this morning in this particular room. I'm so glad that you guys are here. Let me pray for us, and then we'll jump right in. God, thank you so much for today, and thank you for this opportunity at the parenting conference to just all be encouraged, reminded, equipped with ways that we can know you and love you and know and love the children that are gifts that you've given to us but not for us, to be deployed for your purposes and for your glory. And so, Lord, I pray that you'd be with us through the rest of our time this morning. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, so by way of introduction, if we have not met before, my name is Jermaine Harrison, and I've been on staff here at Watermark since 2014, but before that, I was attending Dallas Theological Seminary, and while attending seminary, I started attending Watermark in the spring of 2012. I went through the membership process, and immediately myself and my roommates started to serve with our student ministry. And back then, the students thought that myself and my roommates were some sort of skit character thing that Bron Brown and David Penuel had come up with, because at that point in time, I had a roommate that was from Northern Ireland, a roommate from Australia, and I was from Jamaica, and then our fourth roommate was from Atlanta, Georgia, but his family is Israeli. And so this hodgepodge truly from around the world came to the high school ministry at the same time with different accents, and the kids were like, there's no way this is real. But it was real. It was all of us that the Lord in his sovereignty brought to our student ministry at that point in time. And later on that fall, I gave my first sermon here at Watermark to our students, and here's a picture, a Photoshop that was put together from that very first sermon. It was a series we were going through called Man Up / Godly Woman, talking about biblical manhood and biblical womanhood. And so on that picture of, let's throw that picture back up there. On that picture, you'll see that I thought being a man was being married to Jennifer Aniston, of course, having a Ram pickup truck, a huge house, being as tall as LeBron James, having a ton of cash. And, you know, we started on a great journey, truly, myself and my roommates, of getting to be a part of all that God has done here at Watermark through the student ministry. And so the next few photos are really just highlights, if you will, of moments throughout my time here serving in at D-Town, which is our large in-town retreat during the spring semester. I've also gotten the opportunity to go to Haiti and the Dominican Republic and to Camp Barnabas, a camp for individuals with special and additional needs, and Dallas Experience down in the South Dallas area, and on I could go. But one of my favorite things about being a part of the student ministry and even on staff here at Watermark is the privilege I got to lead a small group of guys from the time they were in sixth grade all the way till they graduated high school. And so on the left is a picture of us at our first ever wake retreat when the guys were in sixth grade, and every small group was given a periodic table as an element as their, you know, kind of character, if you will, and that's us dressed up there. And then on the right is our last D-Town, which was this past February. So these guys are now off at Texas A&M, the majority of them. One's in the Czech Republic randomly. We got Texas Tech, and what else do we have? And then we have also here in Dallas at a community college. So anyways, it has been such a joy and a privilege and a gift to get to truly be a part of families' lives for the last 10 plus years. I've spent a lot of time with students over the last decade plus, and I've walked through the highs and lows of life that one can experience. I've sat in the backyard of a student whose father had just committed suicide hours after it happened. I've sat in hospital rooms as children of parents passed away. I've sat with students who've walked through divorce in their family or exciting things like graduation and heading off to college, relationships and breakups, loss of friend groups, and you name it. And I've just gotten to see students grow in their faith as they were cared for and shepherded by parents like you and the small group leaders that were a part of Watermark students over the years. And so this summer, I knew I was going to give this message or this topic, this breakout at the parenting conference, what your teen wishes they could tell you. And so I thought, why don't I get some actual lines or thoughts that students would share with their parents if they could. And so over the summer, I would sit at dinner or different meals with students, or even at our large group gatherings, I would have them text in anonymously, of course, to a phone number to answer the question, hey, if you could have a conversation with your parents about something that maybe you're nervous to, or you don't know how the conversation might go, or that you would hope you'd be able to have and there'd be no conflict, etc., what would you say if you could have any conversation with your parents? And the slide up on screen is really some of the most common ones that I got. If you have the app, the Uncommon Parenting app, and you go to our breakout, you can click the slides, and all of these slides are on there. So you can take a picture of it, you can write down notes, you can do whatever, but just know that if you miss anything, we also have these slides and notes available for you on the Uncommon Parenting app, okay? So these were some of the most common responses that I got from students. The first one is this. I want them, my parents, to understand how to give me earned freedom. In other words, as I get older, giving me more responsibility and letting me understand what it means to be an adult and make choices and live with the consequences. The second one is I want them to understand the impacts of technology and social media on life at home and school. And this was probably one of the most fascinating ones that they were telling on themselves that, man, I understand the impact and influence of social media that it has on me in all the contexts that I'm in. And I want my parents to know and understand that as well. The third bullet on there is I wish my parents understood the power of their words over me. And the fourth one kind of goes in tandem with that one. We listen to y'all more than you think. And so just the idea of your words matter, your encouragement, your advice, your wisdom, the life that you speak over your kids, they matter and they notice them. Next, they said, I wish my parents and I could calmly work through conflict together. And then next, desiring to hang out with friends does not mean home isn't fun or that you fail as a parent. That was an oddly specific one that kept coming up over and over again. I was like, okay, I guess it's going to make the list. And then the last common one was that being a teenager is hard. So those are real wishes that real teenagers really want to have these types of conversations, or maybe they have had them with their parents. And so I think it was really helpful, even to just as someone who works with students, to get to hear and see what they're actually thinking about and wrestling with. And so some of the reasons that your teenager or other teenagers might be hesitant to share things like this with you, I wrote down that they're immature, that their brains literally haven't fully developed, right? And that they're going through a formative period in their life where hormones are raging, they're searching for their identity, they're trying to figure out their purpose, their social friend group, their meaning, their value. All of those things are contributing to your teenager students being in a place where they're just not as mature as they can be or will be to be able to have these conversations with you. So maybe a reason they're hesitant to share is they're immature, or maybe it's because they're insecure. Even though they might not want to admit it, they really, really, really care what you think about them. And they don't want to seem weak or vulnerable or that they don't have it all together or that they need mom and dad's help, right? And so that might be another reason they might be hesitant to share. And then lastly, it might be because they're unsure of how you might respond. Like they might think to themselves, if this is a conflict that I can avoid by not having this conversation, I just won't have it. And so those are some helpful framework for you to think through. Hey, there might be some conversations that my kid isn't having with me or willing to have with me yet, and it's because they're immature, or maybe they're insecure, or maybe they're just nervous about how I might respond to them. And so hopefully over the next 20 minutes or 30 minutes or so, I'll get to share with you and you get to hear as I speak on behalf of them, with myself being a parent, to encourage you and hopefully remind you of things that you're already doing or maybe things you already know that you can take back into your family and into whatever your context might be and be able to lead the next generation to follow Jesus and to be the church. As Psalm 145 says that we talked about last night, one generation shall commend your works to another and shall declare your mighty acts. And so the hope and prayer of this time isn't to show you all the ways that you're deficient or maybe missing the mark or anything like that, but hopefully to further equip you and encourage you with ways that you can lead, care, and love your teenagers. So I'm going to share with you six things that your teen wishes they could tell you. Six things your teen wishes they could tell you. And these are all, coming out of those answers and responses that they gave over the summer. So number one, the first thing that your teen wishes they could tell you is, I need an example. I need an example. We've sat around here for the past two decades, that the most common indicator of a young person standing firm in their faith long after they've left the home, when they're in college or whatever is after high school, or they get married and they move on with the rest of their lives, the most common indicator that they will hold on to the faith that was entrusted to them isn't an incredible youth group or an awesome youth pastor, although they have one, or any other things like that. The most common indicator is at least one parent in the home walking with Jesus and modeling what it looks like to know God, to love God, and to follow God. That's the most common indicator. And so really, the thing that your teenager or teenagers that you'll have in the future, what they need probably the most from you is an example from your life. A couple of years ago, I saw this meme, and I laugh because it so illustrates maybe some feelings that parents have about their opportunity and responsibility for discipleship. This is from the Babylon Bee, if you're familiar with it. And it says, parents fulfill duty to bring kids up in the Lord by dropping them off at youth group for an hour every week. And obviously, it's a joke, right? That there's no way that spiritual formation in the lives of your teenagers is going to happen once a week, dropping them off at a small group or bringing them to, a church event or whatever it might be. But that the other hours all throughout the week that you're with them at home in the mornings, afternoons, nighttime, over the course of those years that the Lord has entrusted you with them, that you have the greatest opportunity to be an example that they can look to and follow and learn from. In fact, we see this clearly in Scripture. This past summer, as we've been reading through Join the Journey, we spent some time in the book of Judges, and Judges chapter 2, verses 6 through 10 really stood out to me on this point of being an example. So I'm going to read those verses to you from Judges chapter 2, verses 6 through 10. It's also up on the screen. And so just so you know where we are in the story, Joshua and the leadership of Israel, they have conquered all of the promised land. They've settled, where all of the different tribes of Israel are going to live. And there's this kind of last charge before Joshua dies in Judges chapter 2, verses 6 through 10. When Joshua dismissed the people of Israel went each to his inheritance to take possession of the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works that the Lord had done for Israel. Verse 8, and Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110 years. And they buried him within the boundaries of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of the mountain of Gaash. Notice verse 10. And all that generation also were gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them who what? Who did not know the Lord or the work he had done for Israel. And so oftentimes when I've read the book of Judges, or maybe you've read it, or you maybe have even heard someone from stage like me say, man, Joshua didn't raise up another generation of leaders to continue passing on the truth about who God is and the miracles and the works and the wonders and the encouragement to continue to follow God. And while that might be true, what we also see here is that no one else did either. And that in every single Israelite home, or by and large the majority of them, what they did was they kept the works of the Lord and the ways of the Lord to themselves. They did not pass it on to the next generation. And so therefore, a generation arose who did not know the Lord or the work he had done for Israel. And it's so interesting to see how quickly a spiritual heritage can be lost. With just one generation deciding, or you know, whether intentionally or unintentionally, to not pass on a love and hunger for God. And so the encouragement to you and I is our example is the greatest testimony to our students that there's a God in heaven who loves us, who sent his son Jesus to live, die, and raise again from the dead, to reconcile us to God, and not just to give us a ticket to heaven, but so we can live differently every single day in our words, our thoughts, our actions, in every way that we conduct ourselves. We are examples, and our example is so important for our students, our kids, our teenagers to follow. And I see that so often in my own personal life every single day now in a unique way. My son Winslow is 2.5 years old, and there's been many mornings where I'll sit down to spend time in God's word, and he wants to come and, Dad, read the Bible, or he sees me journaling, and he wants to journal too, and his journaling is just scribbling on a sheet of paper. But in those moments, I've disciplined myself to remind myself of the fact that he is seeing what I'm doing and wanting to follow it. And hopefully, prayerfully, I won't just do it when he's, you know, a two-year-old, but that when he's 13, Lord willing, when he's 16, that he would continue to see that me and my wife are people of prayer, people that are dependent on the Lord every single day. And so maybe the challenge, if you will, that I'd give to you is, when was the last time your kids saw you truly spending time in God's word, or having a conversation about what you've been learning or how you've been challenged to grow in your own personal walk with the Lord, or maybe in something that you're struggling or wrestling with? When was the last time you prayed together as a family, like with your teenagers, as awkward as they might feel or want to make it out to be in that moment? When was the last time you modeled for them and were an example for them of the value and importance of spending time with the Lord? And so, the first thing that your teenager needs, wishes they could tell you, is that they need your example. They need to be able to look to you and see how you love and follow the Lord. Number two, the second thing your teen wishes they could tell you is, I need empathy. I need empathy. Being a teenager is hard, as we talked about at the beginning. Being a teenager is hard. Now, I know the objection in the room, and I understand it, and I empathize with the objection. Being a teenager is hard. Try being an adult, right? Try being a parent with responsibilities and a job and mortgage and aging parents or different challenges and circumstances in life. Comparatively, being a teenager is easy. So I empathize with you. However, at the same time, because of where they are in life and the circumstances that they're experiencing, being a teenager for them is hard. It really is. And you and I as parents have an opportunity to empathize with them and understand what they might be going through. Teenagers today are searching for identity, belonging, and purpose in the most confusing and complicated culture. And so for us, really listening to them and seeking to understand and getting into their world without trying to solve problems or without dismissing what they're going through goes a really long way. This school year in Shoreline, our high school ministry, we're going through a sermon series we're calling The Fight for Your Mind. And the goal of this series is to help students embody and follow 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 4 and 5, which talk about taking your thoughts captive and making them obedient to Christ. And the reason we've been going through this sermon series is because in a unique way, in our day and in our cultural context, studies are coming out every few months that highlight that Generation Z, your children that are, you know, 9, 10, 11, and on into their teenage years and early 20s, that your children, Generation Z, is the most stressed, depressed, anxious, distracted, lonely, suicidal, and confused generation in history. And the thing is that while these studies are coming out, you know, on a monthly basis about this population that makes up 68 million people in America, here's the thing, your children, Generation Z, are the most self-aware generation in history as well. They don't need these studies to show or to prove to them that they are the most stressed, depressed, anxious, suicidal, confused generation of all time. They already know it because they sit in their classrooms, they go on social media, they talk to their friends, they literally just look around at the world. They already know that they are in a unique and challenging cultural moment. It is hard to be a teenager. So the question I want to ask you or challenge you with is, how are you growing in empathizing with your student, with your teenager? How are you seeking to understand? What questions are you asking them versus having a posture of, hey, my life is hard enough and being a teenager is really easy compared to what I'm going through? How are you seeking to understand? How are you seeking to empathize with them? One of the ways that I've tried to do that and want to share this resource with you is a parenting organization called AXIS, A-X-I-S, and they have a ton of resources like articles and videos equipping you on a Christian worldview of how to parent your kids or how to think through cultural issues and challenges, you know, gender, all of these different things. And it is such a helpful website. But one of the things that they do on a weekly basis, they have this newsletter called the Culture Translator. And they send out an email with, hey, here's the most popular song that's going on, that's topping the charts on Spotify or whatever it might be. And here's the message of the song. And here's a question that you might consider thinking about for yourself or having a conversation with your teenager about. And so, anyways, you might not want to use that. And I know that we're going to give you some more resources as parents through our newsletter that we'll share with you at the end of this conference. But by and large, the goal that I want to share with you is that we have an opportunity to empathize, to understand what our students, our teenagers are going through versus just dismissing it and problem solving. Okay? So that was the second thing that your teenager wishes they could tell you. I need empathy. Number three, the third thing your teenager wishes they could tell you is, I need encouragement. I need encouragement. And who couldn't do with a little bit more encouragement? Encouragement strengthens. Encouragement inspires. There's not a person in this room that reflects on their childhood and their upbringing and goes, you know what I wish? I wish my parents encouraged me less than they did. Like, there's no one in this room that says that. Being encouraging is such a powerful resource and tool for you as a parent, especially of teenagers. Proverbs 12, verse 25 says this, anxiety in a man's heart weighs him down, but what? A good word makes him glad. So truly, when was the last time you intentionally encouraged your teenager or your other kids, whatever age they might be? When was the last time you intentionally sought to encourage them? on our team, our students team, we've put into practice regular encouragement. And so on a weekly basis, when our team meets, we have a segment in our team meeting called, I Heard Something Good About You. Truly. And it's an opportunity for those of us in the circle to encourage in front of each other, other people in the room about something that they did, a way they handled a pastoral situation, a way that they just faithfully served. And the reason for that is because I wanted to lead our team in being more encouraging to each other. And I say and encourage you to do the same with your family. And that might be sending a text message to your son or your daughter with things that you've seen in them, or ways that you've seen them grow in their faith, or ways that they've just been a joy and a blessing to be around. Encourage them. Could be through a text message. Could be through writing a handwritten note. Those still are possibilities. Or even just having a conversation with them in person. I am encouraged by the way that you fill in the blank, you know. Our students, your teenagers, your children do so well to be encouraged and strengthened and refreshed by their own parents. Even if they feel like they don't want it or they don't need it or it doesn't impact them, they told you, like I shared at the beginning, that your words have power in their lives. And so the third thing that your teen wishes they could tell you is, I need encouragement. Number four, the fourth thing that your teenager wishes they could tell you is, I need earned freedom. I need earned freedom. And I think this is probably one that you're most familiar with. And I've been trying to learn about this as I've heard a lot of kids talk about wanting to experience this, that they don't want to be treated the same way they were when they're 12, if they're 15 or if they're 17 or whatever it is, but that incrementally over time they get and experience more freedom and of responsibility and consequences by their parents. And so one of the things that I've done in the last year or so is start to read some parenting books that really focus on this idea. And so this is one of them. The book is called Feeding the Hand That Bites You, and it's by an adolescent psychologist. He's a believer. I think there's also a podcast with it that you can listen to. It's really, really helpful. But in that book, there's this quote that I have up on screen, and I'll read it. He says this: before adolescence, your role as a parent is to teach and protect. From 13 years old and on, your role is to train and release. And so there's that transition from teach and protect to train and release. You must have a plan for planned emancipation, slowly and strategically giving your teenager more autonomy as they mature. Be clear on freedoms, expectations, consequences, all along the way. And so if this is a battle maybe that you're currently walking through with your teenager, or anticipate walking through as you observe their personality and wiring, I'd encourage you to read that book. It's a really, really helpful one. Another way I've heard this concept of giving earned freedom over time play out is through those four transitions that you see on screen. You know, when your kid's a newborn or an infant or a toddler, you're a caretaker. And in those like young single digit years, you're a cop. You're protecting them, you're teaching them. And then there's that transition to being a coach where you're an advisor, where you're instructing them, but you're letting them do their thing. And then ultimately you become a consultant that they come back to for advice. But I've also, as I've read or had conversations with parents, even like you guys, the most difficult transition between those kind of four steps, if you will, is a transition from cop to coach. Right? Which makes so much sense. A cop is just like coming in and telling you, hey, this is what you do, this is right, this is wrong, this is how you live. And a coach is more so advising and allowing you to make your choices, right? And so even as parents, like making that shift can be such a challenge. And so I'd encourage you to consider what that looks like for you. Talk with your community group about that, with your spouse about that. Hey, how are we doing at making that transition from being the cop, if you will, in our kids' life, to no longer being a cop, but being a coach and ultimately a consultant. And so your kids, your students, your teenagers, they want earned freedom, and they need it, right? So that by the time they're off in college, they don't need to wonder what mom or dad thinks about this or need to call home for advice, but that they've been appropriately and adequately biblically trained over time and allowed to experience maybe some difficult consequences and not rescued in the moments of trouble they might get in because of the decisions that they make, but that they've learned over time to make choices and hopefully ones that honor the Lord and experience the consequences or the blessings of those choices. And so I need earned freedom is another thing that your teenager wishes they could tell you. Yes? Feeding the mouth that bites you? There you go. I blame myself. I'm sorry about that. Feeding the mouth that bites you. Scratch off that list, that name that you got there. Feeding the mouth that bites you. Feeding the hand that bites you is the right saying. And they went with the, you know, the alternative. Yeah. Or biting the hand that feeds you. Whatever. We got the right name. Thank you. I appreciate it. I got another book I'll recommend to you on this next one. And I have the right name this time. Don't worry. Number five. The fifth thing that your teenager wishes they could tell you is this: I need guardrails around social media and phone usage. I need guardrails around social media and phone usage. This one is interesting, where students have literally looked me in the face and said, I wish my parents would not let me have my phone in my room, or I wish my parents would limit my screen time. Like, genuinely, we've had our team have sometimes gone up to kids and say, hey, can I, just out of curiosity, let me see your screen time. And I mean, it is 75% of the day for some students. Obviously, that's not every single person or every single one of your teenagers, but that is truly the common context in which they live. And they know it, that they need structure, that they need guardrails, and they want you to know it as well. I need guardrails around social media and phone usage. The best time to put in boundaries around phones and social media is the day you give your child a phone or access to social media. And the second best day is today. And so if you haven't already, I would encourage you, from my own personal experience of walking through just different and difficult circumstances with teenagers surrounding their phones and social media, that is something that you should take into careful consideration. Psalm 101 verse 3 says this: I will not set before my eyes anything that is worthless. And that's a convicting verse to read when you think about yourself, you know, scrolling on social media or spending time watching videos on YouTube, and just like, you know, if you were to run the things that we consume, the media that we consume through the lens of Psalm 101 verse 3, there's a lot of things that we shouldn't or wouldn't watch or spend our time doing, right? And I think it's such a convicting exercise to do, and in the same way, to help our students, our teenagers, consider that. How much time am I spending, and what am I spending it on? And so here are a couple guardrails that I would encourage you to consider around social media and phone usage. The first thing is the kind of content. Like, what are they actually consuming? Are you allowing them to just have free rein to watch whatever or to be on whatever? Like, we know this. I'm not telling you anything new. Like, literally, our students are walking around with a pornography resource in their back pocket or in their Lululemon belt bag. They are. They just are. And so how are you thinking about having those conversations with them or putting in whatever guardrails you think are most useful for your particular teenager to help them? When we meet with small group leaders to potentially to see if they would be small group leaders within our ministry as we're interviewing them, I mean, over and over and over again, the constant refrain or story is, you know, I was at a friend's house, we were at a sleepover, or, you know, whatever, some sort of scenario like that, and they pulled up a phone and showed me blank, over and over and over again. And so if we don't understand that that's just the world in which our teenagers live, like, even if you put the guardrails on them on their phone, like, thinking about the friendships or the places they might be, or even in school, or wherever it is that it is, you know, the enemy and this world is throwing things at them to pursue their passions and to seek their own desires. And so you should be mindful of that. Number two, under there, the second guardrail to consider is the amount of time spent consuming content. And we already kind of addressed that with the screen time conversation. And then three is the location of content consumption. And so on this one, I was reading this book by a non-Christian psychologist, adolescent psychologist. Her name is Lisa Damour, L-I-S-A, and last name D-A-M-O-U-R. And she wrote a book called The Emotional Lives of Teenagers that I read along with Reed Towns on our Regeneration for Students team. And it is a powerful book. She's not a believer. There's some questionable examples or words in there. But I would also recommend you read that book. Because, like, even in there, she talks about this and this idea of making sure that your kids don't have access to social media and limiting the time that they have their phones in their rooms and such. And she's like, it is just, the evidence speaks for itself. This non-Christian psychologist is like, hey, we are unwise, truly, if we're allowing our children to have unfettered access, unlimited time of access to their phones and to media apart from our overview in their rooms without any accountability. And so if a non-Christian psychologist is saying this, how much more should we as followers of Jesus who want to help put the right guardrails in place for our students, how much more should we consider it? So there's so much more in that book, but I would recommend that one to you as well. And then the last kind of guardrail I want to encourage you with is through your example, the examples that you set with your own consumption. Because it's easy to tell them, hey, your screen time should be this amount of time, or you shouldn't be watching this, or whatever it might be. But how are you implementing and applying that in your own life? My wife gave me this example a couple of weeks ago where she was just hanging with our son, but she also had her phone out, you know, while they were playing, kicking the ball together or whatever, and our two-year-old son was like, Mom, put down your phone. Like, he literally said that, and you're just like, oh my gosh. He is noticing that in that moment, you know, her interests were divided or her attention was divided, and how much more do our teenagers see that our interests or our attention is divided in moments where we might be interacting with them and also trying to interact with our phones. And so my wife and I have tried different things to help us in this area in particular. And so every year for the last couple of years, and we're going to do it again, we do a dopamine detox in December. And so that means no social media for the entire month of December. We delete it off of our phone, and no coffee also for the entire month of December. If you want to do it, join us. It's amazing. It's a great exercise in getting some headaches and wondering where Instagram is when you pick your phone back up. So we've done that. I've also tried to do, personally, when I get home from work, turn off my phone for an hour. Like, just literally just turn it off and put it in a drawer and just be with my kids and my wife. And it's not that easy. And there's moments where I want to be like, you know, I need to go check something really quickly or wrap something else up. But those disciplines that I've been trying to implement have been really, really helpful. All right, we're getting close to the end. The sixth thing that your teenager wishes they could tell you is, I need the experience of healthy conflict resolution. I need the experience of healthy conflict resolution. One of the greatest demonstrations of how the gospel transforms us is through how we resolve conflict. Truly. Grace, truth, forgiveness, seeking to understand more than seeking to be understood should mark how we resolve conflict in our marriage, first of all, and then in how that carries over with how we resolve conflict with our children. Proverbs 15:1 says that a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. Truly, the other day, probably a couple months ago, I was walking into church, and again, I don't know the entire context. I don't know this family. I don't even know if they're believers, but, you know, this family was walking into church over there by the East Tower, and I don't know what the kid did, but I was walking right behind them. It was like a maybe 3 or 4 year old boy, and the dad started, screaming at this little kid. And I thought to myself in that moment, not judging this dad, although I probably should have, in my own heart, like, man, how am I in those moments where I'm frustrated by my son or frustrated by something else and allow it to just boil over in the way that I treat my child? And for you guys, as parents of teenagers and parents of kids that will be teenagers, I think that this is such a great gospel opportunity and example setting that you can have in the way that you deal with conflict. In those moments when your kids do something that is truly enraging, and that one of the ways that you can share the gospel truly is in how you respond in that moment. And how you measure your words, or in how you discipline them, not out of anger, but out of love, or whatever else it might be. But your students, your kids, your teenagers need the experience of healthy conflict resolution. Because whatever they see in your home, whether it's between you and your spouse, or you and other of their siblings, that's the training ground for how they think and understand they are to resolve conflict. And we just live in a world where people don't know how to resolve conflict. People just want to say what they want to say in person or online, drop the bombs and make their statements and not actually have a conversation that resembles biblical conflict resolution. And so you and I can make a difference in that by the way that we resolve conflict between each other as spouses and the way we resolve conflict with our kids. So it's 9:42. I'm going to let you guys out of here at 9:45 so that you can take a break, grab some snacks, and head to your next breakout. But again, all of this content is on the app. You can look through it. The only thing that's wrong on there is the name of that book. Thank you. And I want to end by reading to us and over us Psalm 78, verses 3-8. And these verses are another just reminder of our call as parents of teenagers who are the next generation, who will be around if the Lord tarries long after we're gone. Psalm 78, verses 3-8. And it says this, "Things that we have heard and known that our fathers have told us, we will not hide them from their children, but tell to the coming generation the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might and the wonders that he has done." We don't want to be like that generation that began the cycle of sin and rebellion against God in the book of Judges, because none of them passed on the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might and the wonders that he has done. Verse 5, "He has established a testimony in Jacob and appointed a law in Israel, which he commanded our fathers to teach their children, that the next generation might know them, the children yet unborn, and arise and tell them to their children." Isn't it crazy to think about the way that you and I are parenting our kids today will influence and impact generations, like not just their grandchildren that hopefully we'll get to see, but like generations long after we are gone will be influenced and impacted by the way you and I parent today. Verse 7, so that they should set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, and that they should not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation whose heart was not steadfast, whose spirit was not faithful to God. And so whatever your parenting experience prior to this moment, prior to the opportunity of stewardship that that the Lord has given you through the teenagers that you have an opportunity to model what it looks like to love God and to follow God all of your days, and that your teenagers would see, man, mom and dad, they love God and they follow God, and he influences every aspect of their lives. And so let me pray that Psalm 78 will be true of every single one of us as we seek to love and care for our teenagers. God, we love you. Thank you so much for this parenting conference and this opportunity to just rest, reflect, be reminded, and encouraged by all that you're doing. And Lord, I pray that we wouldn't just get great tips and tricks over the course of this weekend for how to be better parents, but that we would be reminded of how good of a father you are to us, and be refreshed in our relationship with you, and by extension and out of the overflow of that, that we would seek to be faithful parents in the lives of the teenagers that you've given us. We love you, and we're so grateful. In Jesus' name, amen.
Let's thank Jermaine, everybody.
Thanks, Dave. Here.
So, Jermaine, it is 9:45. The next breakout doesn't start till 10:15.
10:15.
Oh. So I would love, and I think we all would, the opportunity to ask you some questions.
Great, let's do it.
So if we could do Q&A for about 15 minutes, if you need to slip out, of course you can. But I would love just to open up the floor and see what you have to say.
Totally. I thought it started at 10. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you were lied to.
I blame myself. Yes. Yeah. Will you pass up, bring the mic around? Thank you.
I just wanted to hear the Access website, number one. And number two, just some how-tos on the empathy and the encouragement. Just some tactical, you know, specifics.
Yeah. You want to know what the actual website is, you were saying?
Well, yeah, just how to get that.
Oh, it's the
it's access.org, right?
Yeah, AXIS.org. AXIS.org. You got that one? And then practical examples of the empathy. I would say, like, what I've done with students, with teenagers, is, you know, when I've sat with them and asked them, you know, how was your summer? Or what's something challenging that you're experiencing right now? Is something that Blake Holmes and others have said around here, when you're going through, when someone's going through a hard time or a tragedy, of resisting the urge to say something profound. I think that that's something that I would encourage you with, like, in that moment of, okay, what's maybe the best thing for you to do is just listen and go, man, that's really hard. Or, yeah, you're right. She shouldn't have said that. You know, even if you know, like, man, there is a lesson here that I could so totally give them a Bible verse or an experience from my life that would really, if they just listened to me, this problem would be solved. Like, you're right. It probably would be. But I think that what you would communicate in just listening and just saying, man, that's really hard, or that's really tough that you've experienced this situation, that could be really easily resolved. You know, that's in the back of your mind, but you're not saying it out loud, I think is a great example, or a great way that I've practiced, at least with ministering to teenagers, to just listen without necessarily seeking to solve or help. And even in doing that, I am helping them solve it, if that makes sense. It's a great question.
Listen to the hard and also the good. I found myself, if my teenager goes out and has a good time, wanting to then be like, well, I'm glad you had a good time, but here are some warnings. And rather just being like, I'm so glad you had fun with your friends, and then shutting up. I was thinking of that when you were talking about empathy.
Yes.
All right, we got another question.
Good. Where was the other question? Oh, in the middle right here.
I think our culture just allows a lot of capacity to figure it out on your own. And so, coming from a different culture and not having a lot of cultural precedents for milestones of a young man becoming a man or a young woman becoming a woman, and the power of our words to speak that into existence when they're 12, hey, you're a man now, I'm going to treat you like that, and these type of framework. My question to you is, personally, culturally, from where you grew up in Jamaica, or what have you seen that are milestones that we could draw from and be encouraged by? And is there a resource in Watermark to help us think through a healthy application of that, because there's only a billion options to think about. And it's like, man,
yeah,
what do I want to do for my family?
Totally. The answer from my personal experience is I grew up in a cultural context or family context where truly what my parents believed or thought was their job as parents is to provide for my brother and I, like, you know, financially or opportunity-wise. And there wasn't a lot of what you're describing of the helping you take those next steps or milestones of, you know, you're 13 now, like, here's what I want you to do or whatever it might be. But honestly, I've seen a lot of that here since I've moved to the U.S. I moved here in 2010 to attend Dallas Seminary, and truly I've gotten to see fatherhood modeled in some significant ways by men at this church, you know, elders of this church, people like David Peniel and Bron Brown. And so some examples that they've modeled for me, one example is Easton Brown, who is Bron's youngest son, who's just in college now. He was in my small group. And over the years, we would have what we would call a milestone moments. And so when he turned 13, Bron took him on like a father-son purity retreat, literally. And so they went camping and truly had intentional conversations about what it looks like to, you know, keep your eyes away from worthless things, like what Psalm 101 talked about, and creating a space where he felt comfortable to have those conversations around sex and purity and all of that stuff. And then another example of something that he would do, he would call them manhood dinners. And so the most recent example is when he graduated high school, us as his leaders and some other, his uncle and grandfather and just a bunch of men, like, came together. We ate good food, and we all got to encourage him and give him advice that we would give as he goes off to college. What would we encourage him with? Knowing him specifically, how would we challenge him? What would we remind him of from God's word? And so I think I've just seen similar examples like that from different men in our church body here that I've learned a ton from. Resources that Watermark has, I believe we're gonna share some of that. Faith Path.
Yeah, so stick around till the end of the conference. Sherrod is going to roll out a brand new resource for our church that is specific to your question. It is called Faith Path, and there will be multiple milestones and resources for every life stage it goes through.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good. Yes, back there and then right here.
Is it like one kid said that to you, or was it?
No, they
my child would sacrifice you.
They don't want it, but they know they need it socially, and so they have it. Does that make sense? Like, they understand, like, hey, this is not good for me in a lot of ways, with comparison or with mental health and all of these different things. But truly, a student that honestly doesn't have social media is missing out on a large part of the social experience of being a teenager in, you know, in 2023. They really are. And so you and that teenager who doesn't want to have it has to understand that that's a sacrifice that you're making and being okay with not having that particular social experience. But it is a reality that it is a part of their social their social code of conduct, if you will. Whereas you might have in the past gone to a parking garage and hung out with your friends, or gone to Brahms or whatever. They're doing all of those things, and then they're posting it on Snapchat, and they're seeing where their friends are on Snapchat. They're seeing where the fun things are happening. They're seeing what they were invited to, what they were not invited to, what everyone thinks about. I mean, it's all a part of it. And so they feel a tension where they know, man, this is not good, but also this is a part of the water in which I swim a little bit. So that's how I would answer what you just said. Yeah.
Who was next?
Yeah, right here.
So the guardrails you shared with phone usage and social media, I don't know if you want to do this or not, but I'm just, it's something my husband and I have really struggled with, of what those specifics should be, specifically like the time limits, screen time. Do you have any recommendations?
Is there a way that if you're the parent and you're the owner of the all of the phones, that you can set the limits on the phones?
Yes.
I just do it. Oh, how much time? A lot kids that have screen time from that I know of that their parents, like, you know, have it on their phones, they tell me, you know, anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour is what their parents give them. And then once it locks, it locks. But then they can ask their parents. And if they, you know, it's a conversation like, hey, mom or dad, you know, I'm trying to, whatever, look this thing up or watch this show. Can I do it? And so it's a conversation after that. And most of the time, the parent would, you know, let them do it if it's something reasonable. But at least setting that boundary so you're, like, mentally, like, preparing yourself. Like, I even do that for myself on social media, having, you know, 25-minute a day limit. And if you know the code yourself, it's so easy to go through it. But it's also another hurdle or another reminder, like, hey, you've already been on this, you know, 25 minutes for the day. Like, it's another hurdle to get over to get there. So I think, yeah, if you can, and have that conversation with them and share why you think it's helpful and do it.
You can also do different limits for different days of the week. Like, okay, you know, Saturday can be, you get a little bit more time than you get during the week.
Right. That's a good question. Yes.
On the empathy aspect of it, how do you, or do you have recommendations for drawing the line between when your child comes to you and they want you to empathize with them on a particular situation? They tell you the situation, and then, you know, I am like, oh, I'm so sorry. I understand how that makes you feel. However, I see the side of this other child is usually social. And, hey, don't you see this side too? But in that moment, really, is she just coming to me to have the empathy? Or do you use it to instruct and say, hey, you got to have a bigger perspective here, because see what this kid's saying or doing or feeling?
Right.
How do you draw that line between the empathy and the teaching?
Yeah, I think a helpful way to think about it is to divide that conversation in two, where I would say if they come to you on a Tuesday and share, you know, whatever the circumstances they're talking about, that Tuesday is Empathy Tuesday, right? And the other perspective is for a different day later on in that particular week. And, you know, based on the severity of it or whatever, they might want you to give them instruction in that moment. But I think some of it is also giving some of the control, if you will, of the conversation over to them. You know, let me just empathize. And if they're wanting it to be more than empathy, I'll let them lead, if you will, to have that conversation at the same time. But if I empathize and, you know, that's kind of where it stops, I'm good. I'm gonna save the advice or the sharing for the next day and bring it back up in a, you know, in a casual way.
So even if you think that their reaction is maybe not correct.
Yes.
So it's Empathy Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, you can initiate, hey, I've been thinking more about what you were saying yesterday, and here's something that I thought, and you're initiating that conversation,
right,
and then coaching them through.
Right.
And what that also additionally provides you the opportunity to do, which as a parent, this is convicting, I'm not saying I do perfectly, is to pray about that situation and to pray about that coaching and not react in the moment. Now, sometimes if there's an urgency to it, you're going to have to skip Empathy
right.
Tuesday and go straight to, like, coaching. But oftentimes you can pray, you can prepare, then you can initiate the conversation.
Yeah, that's good.
About at 10, you want to do one more?
Sure, one more, if there is one more. Yes.
So that exact thing happened to me this week. I had usually my oldest brings my sophomore home, and he was off somewhere, and I was picking up the junior high kid and the sophomore kid. And so the junior high kid was mad that he didn't get to go straight home, and the sophomore kid was mad that she was having to wait for me to get the junior high kid before I got her. And all I wanted to do in my flesh was make them both walk home, because I was like, these are the most entitled kids I've ever seen in my entire life. And I prayed in that moment on the way home, like, for wisdom. And as we pulled into the driveway and the junior high kid got out, the sophomore kid said, I had the absolute worst day, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And so it wasn't necessarily about the fact that she had to wait 20 minutes longer, although that played a part. And so I felt like the entitlement piece, like, as much as I wanted to jump on it from the start, because I waited, I heard more of the story.
Right. That's so good. That's a great reminder. Thank you so much for sharing that. Okay, it's 9:59. Thank you guys so much for being here. I really appreciate it. I hope it was helpful. We'll see you guys soon.